The great monarch migration has begun as the butterflies make their way from Canada to Mexico. Can your plants help them on their journey? You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, we'll discuss whether monarchs are making a comeback, along with another flying insect we wish would go away, the spotted lanternfly, with experts here to answer your questions for the full hour. Joining me now are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus. Welcome back, Sarah.
So good to be here.
Great to have you. Ohio State University Extension Educator Carrie Brown. Thanks for being here, Carrie.
Thank you for having me.
And Civic Garden Center Environmental Education Specialist, Luis Aguilar Dwyer. Welcome to the program, Luis.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you all here. They are ready to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Luis, let's start with some happy flying insect news. I've seen more monarch butterflies in my neighborhood. Are they making a comeback?
Well, that is a loaded question.
Okay.
I would say that surprisingly for me, at least I've been here in Ohio for 4.5 years. I've been seeing more monarchs up here. And I think, you know, it does depend on which lens you're in. For me, it's like which state I'm in to be able to see, like actually if I'm in Ohio or Texas. But overwhelmingly, I think I like to lean on that all hope is not lost, that there is a comeback coming. But it kind of depends on what kind of coffee you're sipping on in that morning.
There you go. And I understand that Mexico has really been trying to expand the habitat and make, you know, it more monarch friendly in the various forests where they hang out. Is that your understanding also?
I think it's coming to everyone's attention that there is a unifying message with being able to preserve and want to protect this very, very vulnerable insect. But there are more conservation efforts. It doesn't seem that it's taking off as much as we would like. So I think there are both in tandem, a lot of efforts to want to support them from both countries. So I think my short answer for something like that is that the forest that they love to overwinter, it's called the Bosque de Oyamel, and that's what the locals call it. But for us, there is a lot of concerted efforts to want to protect it. However, those who are wanting to preserve this insect in these forests doesn't look too good for them.
Okay. So, Luis, what can we be planting in our own gardens or yards to help these monarch butterflies and other pollinators?
Oh, yeah, that's a fun question. All right. Yes. So in terms of like the local gardeners, there's a variety of ways that you actually can plant native plants to be able to support not just a monarch, but a lot of native species as well. But one of the favorites are the variety of milkweeds. So there's different varieties of milkweeds depending on which state you're in. In Texas, we love to plant a lot of green milkweeds, and we have a lot of antelope horn. And so in Ohio, there is a lot of tuberosa, which is our common milkweed. And then we also have a swamp milkweed, Asclepias incarnata, and then speciosa. So those three would be the ones that I would recommend here in Ohio. But the more you think about it, there's very similarities all over the country. I will say it does depend on which population you're talking about. There's a population on the Western front, and there's one on the Eastern part of the country, which is the ones that we're most familiar with.
Yeah. Anything special you'd plant in Kentucky? Sarah, you're our Northern Kentucky expert here.
Yeah. So I would just recommend keeping in mind, the longer the season, right? So it's not necessarily summer crops, but all the way throughout the fall. So there's lovely asters, for example, that, you know, take those insects, those butterflies, to their journey to Mexico, right? And so just, planting for all seasons. I would also like to note, too, there was a misconception, that decrease in monarchs and other insects, butterflies, due to homeowners or sports turf applicators of certain pesticides. And there may be some truth, minimal truth to that, but it also has a lot to do with our environment. In fact, some of our entomologists at the University of Kentucky shared with me in last year about all of these weather patterns are changing and interrupting the flight patterns of the monarch in particular. So, you know, yes, we're stewards of our environments, good stewards are of our environments, and making sure you read labels accordingly and plant accordingly and water conservation and all these other what I would consider best management practices for our ecosystems and our environment, but some are out of our control, like Mother Nature. So okay. Just want to make note to that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We have a caller on the line. Hey, Alana, thank you so much for calling. What is your question?
Hi. I had a flower garden, and I planted some milkweed seeds last year, and they grew beautifully, and now they're beautifully growing again. They smelled really great, but they took over the entire garden. And now they're just kind of, they're huge and they're just leaning over. And for the safety of, you know, I'm growing them for the butterfly. So when can I cut them down?
Okay. Do you, let me get Carrie in on this. Do you have thoughts on that, Carrie?
Yeah. So, I think, and this kind of goes towards a kind of another issue in the milkweed world, is kind of pay attention to when you see the milkweed and native naturalized habitat starting to decline. I know that tropical milkweed is kind of a controversial topic. A lot of our nurseries will sell it. It is a beautiful plant, has really bright orange and yellow color, but the problem with tropical milkweed is it will, it's been shown to keep monarchs maybe too long, and it's not dying back at the same time as our native milkweed. So I guess I would just kind of pay attention to what those naturalized species are doing. And when you see those start to decline, that's kind of one of the cues that it's time for the monarchs to migrate and cut it back at that time.
Yeah,
or you can always just cut back a portion of it if it is starting to kind of flop over and not behave in your space. Maybe just take a portion of it out.
Yeah, you don't want them to miss the bus. Alana, do you know what kind of milkweed you have?
No, I've ordered several different types of seeds online, and I just put them in, and the real big ones smelled wonderfully, and they were yellow and orange, yes.
Ah, okay. Okay, well, I hope that information helps. I guess you got to kind of watch when they start flopping over.
Then I'm ready. Okay, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you. Thanks for calling. So, Carrie, let's talk about the flying insects we don't want to help and nurture. Spotted lanternfly. I know Hamilton County is one of the counties in Ohio that has an infestation. What do they look like, and what should we be doing about these little guys?
Yeah, so spotted lanternfly is, it's a good-looking insect. It's an insect that I think people notice, which I think helps with outreach efforts, because if you see it, you're probably going to notice it. It looks like a moth or butterfly, but it's actually a sap-sucking insect, so it's more closely related to, say, an aphid or a stink bug. But it has red wings and two sets of wings. The other set of wings is has black spots. And the way that the spotted lanternfly looks is very dependent on its stage and its life cycle. So when it is immature in its nymphal stage, it is black with spots. Eventually, it gains some red. And then come July or August is when the adults emerge. And they have wings, and I think that's kind of the classic spotted lanternfly that people are most familiar with. But the problem with spotted lanternfly is it has a big appetite, and though it does have preferences for food sources, it's been shown to feed on over 70 different species, many of which we care a whole lot about, such as grapes, fruit trees, maple, black walnuts. So because of that, it does have the potential of having an economic impact on our specialty crops.
So what kind of damage do they do to those crops, Carrie? Is it like locusts? Do they just decimate them?
Well, with the spotted lanternfly, and I always like to tell folks, they won't hurt you. So they're not going to bite you. but they are sap-sucking insects. So they have these piercing mouth parts, and they're kind of like vampires on a plant. I always kind of put it like in terms of a tick. With diseases aside, if you just have one or two ticks, it's not going to kill you. But if you're covered with ticks, suddenly you have a problem. So it's same with spotted lanternfly. It will stress a plant, and if a plant is already compromised because of drought or disease or other pests, then they're going to be more prone to damage from spotted lanternfly.
We are talking about gardening for the full hour today, and we have experts here to answer your questions. Call 513-419-7100, or you can send us an email at talk@wvxu.org. So, Carrie, do they end up attracting other pests once they've done their damage to these crops?
Yeah, so interestingly, they do. So as they feed, if you're familiar, if listeners are familiar with aphids, aphids will put out a sugary liquid that they excrete called honeydew. Spotted lanternfly do the same, but because they're bigger insects, they put out more honeydew. So you have this sugary liquid that's being excreted as they feed, and that will fall on anything that's underneath the tree that they're infesting, whether it's, you know, the family minivan or your picnic table or other plants. And when they do fall on other plants, they can cause a fungus called sooty mold to grow, which compromises that plant's ability to photosynthesize. So they can kind of have that pow-pow effect because of that excretion.
Oh, man, that sounds worse than vampires. Sarah, are you seeing spotted lanternfly in northern Kentucky too?
Yes, absolutely. It was recently confirmed. So it's here. We're just building awareness, you know, and especially on the commercial side, which I have yet to see a devastation. But with its wide host range, you know, we're educating our producers, our vineyards, things like that. There are, you know, I'm not really familiar, so maybe Carrie can speak of this, but their life cycle is very interesting. And so we can actually see some of that visually above ground. And so there are some treatment methods, but I think it's just building awareness right now. And like Carrie said, they're a nuisance for us. And so, but unlike some other insects, they have a large host range. And so that's where I'm a little devastated. And I'm not sure the economic side at this point, but due to our vineyards and our orchards, that might be. And because there's already environmental impacts for those crops, I'm very nervous about what can be done. Yeah. Or what is going to be done. So,
right. Carrie, what should we be doing? I mean, your colleague Joe Boggs, who's on our show a lot, he stands up for bugs like nobody's business. But I think even Joe says we can squish these, right?
Yeah, and if Joe says you can squish them, then you know, it won't be bad.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you have small enough populations, squishing them is great. I think raising awareness. I know that with the Ohio Department of Agriculture, they have a portal set up where you can report observations if you find them in counties that are already do not have a quarantine. And they do have a map of quarantine counties, which is of course growing. They overwinter as egg masses. So knowing what an egg mass looks like, and you can squish those during the winter, you can scrape them off into soapy water, that will kill them, can go a long way. And removing their preferred host plant is actually Tree of Heaven, also known as ailanthus. It is an invasive species. It's actually been here since the 1700s, but they come from the same part of Asia. So now that they have both found their way over here to North America, they have found each other once again. So they prefer Tree of Heaven. So removing Tree of Heaven can help to keep populations down as well.
Mm, reunited. Well, we have another caller on the line. Hi, Kirk. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for calling. What is your question?
So my wife planted hundreds of Mexican sunflowers. I know they're not native, but we have lots and lots of monarchs. And my other question, though, is, when I was growing up, we had fields of milkweed, and I believe we used to have lots of monarch caterpillars. Isn't that true that they used to breed in Ohio.
Luis, do we have are we a monarch baby breeding ground?
Well, there's a lot of babies in Ohio, and there's a lot of hopefully more monarch caterpillars coming out too. And I will say that in most cases, when we've been growing a lot of milkweed, there has been a different kind of agricultural practice too, with adding pesticides and applicating those kind of chemicals. I think because a lot of them they're just readily available and just sprayed onto your plants. They didn't just affect the monarch butterfly. It affected a lot of pollinators that were really important for our ecosystem. And so when we're talking about the decline of monarchs, it really came down to three reasons, and we can pinpoint them, but it's a lot of pesticide use, loss of habitat for them to be able to roost, especially in the overwintering sites in Mexico. But also there is a parasite, so diseases. So I would say that when it comes to being able to have monarchs, you definitely want to have, I'm just speaking for monarchs, but also many pollinators, you want them to have accessible habitat that they can thrive in, nectar sources for sure. But also, I like to think of, so this may sound left field, but I grew up with the Buc-ee's gas stations from back home, in Texas, and they were, I'm from Houston, Texas, and Buc-ee's originated south of me, where I was from, in Lake Jackson. It was a tiny little gas station, and now I'm looking at my Google Maps, and there is going to be a Buc-ee's coming up to Dayton, Ohio, in April 2026. I'm not marketing for them. I'm really excited. I'm a big fan. But I like to think of these Buc-ee's as, not just truck stops. They have the best bathrooms, right? and if you've been to one, you'll know. But for milkweeds, I like to think of them as a truck stop for these monarchs. And, it's interesting because that truck stop happened south of Texas. Now they're up in Ohio. I think Lexington is the closest one. But as I'm digressing, to come back to milkweeds, they want their nectar source. But if you think about it, if you are a pollinator making your way, there's several different generations of monarchs. So right now, the ones that are transitioning into fall, they are, at the end of the summer, there is a generation that actually lives for 8 months. So right now, the ones that are being born and being able to come out as from their chrysalises as monarch butterflies, they're making their migration down south. And they'll live for 8 months as opposed to just a couple of weeks. So not each generation is the same. They all serve a different purpose. And the best way that I can say is that, yes, put your native milkweeds, but they need to make their way back home to start over their cycle again.
Yeah. It sounds like they like those Mexican sunflowers. Must remind them of where they go to for the winter. Thanks so much, Kirk. We really appreciate your listening. Okay. Appreciate your call. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
We are talking about gardening for the full hour today. We will be back with our gardening show after a short break. Now is a good time to call with your questions. The number is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with today's gardening show with experts here to answer your questions. My guests are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, Ohio State University Extension Educator Carrie Brown, and Civic Garden Center Environmental Education Specialist Luis Aguilar Dwyer. If you have questions for them, and we know you have questions, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wbxu.org. Carrie, we did get a call during the break or right before the break about spotted lanternfly. Kevin called to ask. He heard that spotted lanternfly are also attracted to milkweed, but that milkweed is poisonous for them. Is there any truth to that?
Well, that's interesting. I honestly don't know if milkweed is one of its host plants. Hmm. It's not something that I have observed, at least.
Okay. Maybe they avoid it because they're smarter than we are. Yeah. You never know with those little pesky bugs. Okay, Kevin. Well, we're not sure about that. Do either of you know about whether milkweed is the enemy of the spotted lanternfly?
The only thing I can say is I know that the milky sap, that when you break that open, even for me, it kind of, it irritates my skin, but then I wash it and it goes away. Perhaps, again, I've never seen any literature on this, but perhaps it has a negative, you know, reaction to that spotted lanternfly and it just moves on. But again, I have no idea. Because it is a sucking, piercing mouth, and it could, you know, digest, I guess, that milky sap, perhaps. But again, I have no idea.
Okay. Well, we have another caller on the line. Hey, Andrea, thanks so much for listening and for calling. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for the show. I love the topic. Definitely a fan of the Monarch. I've been planting swamp milkweed for the Monarchs for about 6 years now, and I have about 8 patches. About a couple foot by a couple foot big, and usually only see about 10 at the most caterpillars. But this year I had like over 80 caterpillars, and all of my swamp milkweed is down to the stems, like no leaves left. And I was wondering what, if you have any ideas why I saw such a big increase this year.
Wow, it sounds like you plant some tasty milkweed. Good for you. Luis, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, number one, you're a rock star. Thanks for putting that so much milkweed. Yeah, swamp milkweed, I do think it's, you know, very dependent on where it's being planted. And I've been hearing a lot of good stuff of swamp milkweed. So that one for me is like Asclepias incarnata. And that one does surprisingly more well here in Ohio. I'm wondering if it's having anything to do with the conditions for the climate for it to thrive in. And speaking from experience in Texas, it's really hot. And if you're trying to cultivate the native milkweeds, it's very, very, you know, temperature dependent. So if you have a lot of swamp milkweed, that's a great problem to have. And I will say, I think mostly, you know, it does come down to just a food source for them. If you're having a lot of monarch caterpillars chomping away at your milkweed plant, I think there is a lot of efforts being made locally, a lot of local gardeners that are getting more familiar with planting the best monarch caterpillar food sources. So, you know, I know we mentioned earlier there was a tropical milkweed, and that one has an orange and red bloom. It almost looks like a crown when you look at it up close. You know, within its name, tropical milkweed, that one is supposed to be planted in Mexico. And, you know, you plant it and you will have a lot of monarchs that will come, but they won't move anywhere else. They'll just stick around. When it comes to managing something like that, what I've grown up with a lot of local gardeners in Texas, you know, they will still plant milkweed because it's readily available, tropical milkweed because it's readily available. But what they'll do is that the best management practice that people have come up with is chomping away and clipping off the blooms at the end of fall. So they don't make that stop. They're kind of like continuously finding their next bucky, so to speak.
Well, Andrew, yeah, and I did hear, I read in preparing for this, that there were many more monarchs that were successful in Mexico this year than there had been years past. That doesn't mean they're out of the woods, so to speak. They're still in trouble, but maybe it's just word of tiny mouth spreading that your place has great milkweed. So congratulations on your great success.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Wow, lots of Monarch fans out there. Again, we are talking about gardening for the full hour today. We've got experts here to answer your questions about all kinds of stuff. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Sarah, let's talk about what we should be doing right now when it comes to tree care and lawn care. What's on your to-do list this time of year?
Yeah, so great. So fall is the preferred time if you would like to renovate your lawn or reseed your lawn. Fall is the best time for temperature, less weed population competition, and less disease and less rain to wash away your seed. I say that kind of with a laugh because we've had so much rain. And the second best time would be like a winter seed, or some people may say a snow seed, followed by a spring seed would be the third option and less preferred. But I always say seed if there's ever any bare spots, like for whatever reason, maybe you dug something up or whatever the case may be, right? We don't want soil erosion, which we have had quite a bit of that in different communities and different parts of the state and surrounding. So, you know, I really, you know, whatever, if you have a hillside or something, make sure it has some types of vegetation. So get off my soapbox about that. But we do have a class at the Campbell County Cooperative Extension Office on September 3rd about fall lawn care. So please reach out about that. And then as far as other landscaping duties in the fall, yes, pruning trees, shrubs, most of them in the fall, there are always exceptions to the rules, right? I think of fruit trees, that is, you know, winter, like February-ish, which we usually talk about that around that time on the show. But yeah, planting is great. I have a personal experience and recommendation. I live in an area where it is a lot of deer pressure. And
that's
yes,
a nice way to put it, deer pressure.
So, you know, I get really excited as a horticulturalist and I'm always like, okay, I'll add this or this or this to the landscape, right? And I've really learned over the years, even with all of my different types of tactics of reducing deer activity. So it's not just the eating in the fall, it's the rutting, right? And so the boy deer like to come rut their itchy antlers on anything that you may have in your landscape. And so with that being said, I like to do my, you know, with that in the spring. And also there's for some plants, a larger availability in the nurseries in the spring. But I don't want to discourage you from fall planting because there's still quite a bit of plants that you can put in the fall. Absolutely. So it always is really nice to garden in the fall. It is so spectacular. Low humidity, very low disease and insect pressure. I mean, it's just fabulous. You connect with your plants, or at least I do. And I don't know, drinking my coffee as I'm like frolicking in the garden is like amazing. And then also like vegetable gardening is spectacular in the fall as well, right? The carrots are by far the best in the fall. They're so sweet. And then kale, spinach, all your leafy greens, you can still be growing and having those fresh salads. My tomatoes, for example, this time of year are loving life because they're turning red right now. There's not as high humidity, which they don't like that high humidity and high temperature. They kind of stop. And so, you know, all those green tomatoes that you've probably witnessed on those vines are now going to start turning red. So get all your tomato recipes ready because here they come. So if you can't tell, I love fall gardening. But then I get really sad because day length come, you know, shortened day length, and then it's like winter. But then I'm like, okay, spring's right around the corner. So I hope that answered all your questions, Lucy.
Yes, yes. Now, you said the words deer pressure, which again, I know I really like that phrase, but this reminded me, we get questions on the show all the time. Is there anything that you can plant that the deer don't like? I mean, are there any fun plants that maybe are good for pollinators that, mm-hmm. that the deer are like, no, thank you?
So I like to start this conversation or suggestions by saying it is offering a variety of deterrents and or planting strategies, okay? So, for example, I've enjoyed planting lavender as a border plant, and the pollinators love lavender, especially our honeybees. And there are other plants that I'm thinking of, mountain mint, that is a spectacular insect magnet. And because of those oils in those plants that give us, for me, the lovely scent, deer tend to not like them as much. Mm. I say as much. There is never a deer-proof plant unless you're talking about a silk flower. Like, that's no joke. Like, it's real. And so...
You mean like a fake silk flower?
Like a fake silk okay, flower. Yeah. And so I say that because the younger fawns in the spring, they're just like our young children, they are curious about everything. So they might take a little nibble and then they might say, oh yeah, that wasn't good. But they're going to still take a nibble or two and then learn from that, right? So each generation, there you have to learn from that, right? And so it can there's resistance, okay? But rutting, there's no resistance minus, you know, so there's fencing techniques that you can do. There's sound deterrence, visual deterrence, sound. Yeah, I already said sound, sorry. And so there's all these different strategies that you can implement. There's even sensory smell, odor things that you can purchase and apply. So I do all of that. And I will say not doing just one is not the fix-all, right? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I do plant, research has shown or implemented lavender, for example, and all these other botanicals, herbal botanicals that they can steer away from those. But I also have other, you know, I have a diverse planting palette, right? And so it's not just lavender. So I hope that answers your question. Yeah, and it is, I will say, and I'm not a wildlife biologist by any means, but I have spoken to some. And it is, the city deer have a different, I'm going to say, mindset compared to the deer in the rural or the countryside. I have no idea why. but, you know, that is what I've learned and experienced and witnessed. And even though, like, I live on the border of a lovely park and forest, they still just welcome themselves into my yard. And that is, you know, there's nut trees, there's a diverse diversity in the forest, but yet they come to my yard, you know, and I'm sure, you know, others have experienced that too.
Yeah. Well, we got an email from Sue. Sue writes, I have leaf rot on my hydrangeas. We tried spraying them with a copper fungicide, but it didn't help. I have pulled off the affected leaves, but is there anything else I can do? Sue also wants to know, my backyard hydrangeas didn't bloom this year. Is there any hope for next year? What may help? Carrie, are you familiar with hydrangeas? Do you have tips for Sue?
A little bit. I know that we've seen a lot of leaf diseases this year because of the wet spring we had. It just didn't stop raining. So those wet leaves, high humidity, poor air circulation is kind of perfect for development of fungal leaf spot diseases. Any leaves that are falling, maybe going getting those. Removing those from that area. So raking those up, removing those from that area so that if it is some type of pathogen that is able to overwinter, you're getting that out of there. And pruning as well. So opening that shrub up some so that air circulation is improved and it's able to, you know, dry out between those rain events.
Yeah, that sounds like a good tip. And Sarah, if the backyard hydrangeas didn't bloom this year, is there hope for next year? Is there anything she can do to help?
Yeah, and hydrangeas are one that could be exception to the rule because depending upon where their buds are on, meaning are they on new wood or old wood? So kind of a general rule of thumb is if a plant blooms before June 1st, I like to pinpoint towards, you know, a dogwood and a redbud, you prune after it flowers. So it blooms on last year's growth, okay, old wood. Whereas it blooms after that date, then it's blooming on new wood. And so if one were to prune in the inaccurate time, then you would easily be pruning off your hydrangea buds. Also, hydrangeas really don't need to be pruned at all, unless you need to keep them in a certain shape or size or something like that. At our education garden, the one that we really prune the most often, which is like every 5 years, is the oak leaf hydrangea. Also, some hydrangeas, like the Bobo hydrangeas, they prefer more sun, ironically, than some other hydrangeas. So the species on that is really important to know. Just because it was blooming in the nursery when you bought it doesn't necessarily mean that's its natural life cycle. It's been forced to bloom for selling and marketing reasons, right? So, you know, feel free to give me a call or an email if you're not sure of what it is. what species it is, sorry, then I would just not prune it and let it go through its natural life cycle. Last point is perhaps it is in too, it's either too wet because they don't like wet feet for the most part, and it's not enough sun and it prefers more sun. I know that is a lot, but hydrangeas are a little finicky because it depends on what species.
Yeah. I'm kind of finicky too. So I maybe that makes all makes sense to me. Well, we'll be back after a quick break to finish up today's gardening show. If you have questions or comments, the time is now. Call 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with today's gardening show. My guests are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, Ohio State University Extension Educator Carrie Brown, and Civic Garden Center Environmental Education Specialist Luis Aguilar-Dwyer. If you have questions, call 513-419-7100, or, of course, you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. Okay, Sarah, we've talked about a lot about different kinds of bugs, but let's talk fall webworm. What's going on with fall webworm?
Yeah, so that is an insect that a lot of people are starting to see now. Fall webworm is a little a caterpillar that builds a web towards the tips of our plants. So in the morning or in the evening, when those fuzzy little, some may say they're cute, some may say deer are cute, but I have a different thought about that. So when they go back to their tent, that is a good opportunity, you know, if possible, cut those out, because what they're doing, similar to monarch caterpillars, they have chewing mouthparts and they are chewing away. They have a wide host range for these fall webworms. So they do have also a lot of poop that will get on the ground, and you may run into a lot of cobwebs. I put those in quotation marks because it's not really a cobweb. But I say that because I was like, gosh, why am I like, there's all these cobwebs everywhere and what is happening? And then I look up and I was like, oh, so they're like strings and it like kind of looks like magic. It's like, oh, here's this little caterpillar dangling. But what's it doing? It's trying to make its web or you know, in the tips of the trees. And then you might look down and you see all this scattering of black little dots, and that's its poop. And so looking at all these clues, and then sometimes we fail to look up under a tree or a tree canopy, and then it's like, oh, there they are. So there are, you know, a systemic chemical that you can apply if the outbreak is year after year after year. Usually, you know, it's not going to come, you know, it's not going to do much damage, especially to older trees. For example, I have quite a few locusts in the garden. They, in fact, devoured pretty much this whole tree. I was talking to an arborist on Thursday, last Thursday. He actually stopped because he's like, I saw that whole plant covered in fall webworm. And I was like, it's fine. He's like, yeah, because they're about to defoliate anyhow. And this is a very mature tree. And so it's not going to be that big of a deal. It's its first time that I've noticed the severity of fall webworm in our education garden. So I'm not going to apply a systemic. Now, if this continues or if it were a new planting that is of value, an orchard or something like that, then I would be thinking of botanical eradication ideas, or a systemic herbicide, or excuse me, pesticide that I could apply. But in this instance, just because I see it, and I want to emphasize this, just because you see a weed or a pest or a disease doesn't always mean, okay, what am I going to spray? Like, I don't think that way. I think of what it, first of all, identification, its life cycle, the severity, the economic loss or impact that it may have. So I just want to mention that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we got an email from Carl. Carl writes, I am thinking of putting a rain garden in our yard, and I'm curious if it is practical or possible to incorporate a small pond in it. The rain garden would be about 10 feet by 10 feet, and the pond would only take up a small portion of that. Carrie, what do you think? Pros and cons of a small pond in the rain garden?
Well, I'm not an expert on rain gardens. I guess I would wonder, you know, how much how much water is going to flow during precipitation events into that area. And if it would, I'm going to pass this one to Sarah, Louise.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Fair enough. Sarah, take it away.
So a rain garden is actually, it can hold water for a period of time and be dry, right? If you want something to hold water, it's going to be a bog garden, a wetlands, or just a pond, right? So, you know, I wouldn't class, because the plant species that one would choose for these particular ecosystems vary, right? And so rain gardens, for example, again, they could be dry for a lengthy period of time and they could be wet for a period of time, but there's drainage, okay? And it's going to be collecting a situation where there's excessive rainfall, especially in the spring, right? And so I would just make sure to identify your desires and your needs for that particular spot. There's also a quick test. And if someone's like, well, I don't know if it drains well, or it's called a percolation test. And so you just dig a hole, I say 12 inches, or you could go 24 inches. Each inch represents an hour. And so you fill it up, let it drain. And then you fill it up. And the second time that you fill it up, that's where you start measuring. Like, okay, is my soil percolating or draining well? Or is it staying full for the whole 12 hours? And that would be more of a boggy situation. So I have a lovely publication on that. And I would be happy to send that to you if you want to send me an email or give me a call. But there is different situations. Also, I will also note that if it is a pond, you want to make sure that it's not holding water. You need moving water unless you want a mosquito breeding site.
Yeah.
Right. And so just keep that in mind. Maybe you actually want a pond and you want koi fish and you want running water, which is also fabulous. But again, it's those ecosystems are different and plant specimens would be different.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Carl, if you want us to forward your email to Sarah, give us follow-up with at talk@wvxu.org. Carrie, let me ask you this. We've been talking about the difference between invasives and native species. You wrote about the Amur cork tree this time last year? What kind of threat can invasive trees have on our forests and landscapes?
Yeah. So I think just invasive plants in general, I remember growing up, there was a Berenstain Bear book about a case of the gimmies, and the Berenstain Bears, they just wanted, give me this, give me that. But they weren't giving anything back. And that's kind of, I feel, what our invasive species are doing. So they're here, they're consuming space, resources, sunlight, and they are able to outcompete our native species. So but at the same time, they're not giving anything back. Our oak tree is oaks in general, so that genus Quercus is a host plant for over 500 species of Lepidoptera, moth and butterfly caterpillars. Whereas Bradford pear, Callery pear, is known to be a host species for one species of insects. So they're not giving anything back to the environment. So they can really disrupt ecosystems because of that. And like I said, they can outcompete our native species and just kind of push them out of the way, especially our understories. Our understory tends to take a pretty big hit.
Okay. We got an email from Andy. Andy writes, my swamp milkweed has aphids that if a plant, I wanted something from it, I would address. I'm sorry, I'm a little confused by this wording. Wants to address how to remove them. However, these plants are for the monarchs. Okay, so if I address the aphid infestation, will it harm the monarchs? Should I just leave the milkweed alone? What do you think, Louise?
What I've experienced, and you know, we can chime in and have a add on to this, but from my understanding, aphids don't really. I mean, you're going to see aphids on milkweeds no matter what. You can clean them off, sure, but I think there's a neutral relationship there.
They're there. If you were to apply even a botanical, and I say this because some people, I'll just use a horticulture oil or horticulture soap. Yes, that may, and it's organic, that may have some control, but guess what? It's also controlling the monarch caterpillar, because it has a wide spectrum of what it controls. And it's not, you know, it's not going to, oh, well, you're beneficial insect and you're not.
Yeah.
So just be very mindful. If it's bothering you for whatever reason, I mean, the hose is where to go. So you just hose them off. They give life birth. And so what that means is there's hundreds and thousands of them, maybe not thousands, but hundreds. They are gross to me. I don't know. They're kind of like, ugh. There's winged aphids and wingless, so they can move depending upon their host range. But also what's so beautiful about Mother Nature, the ladybugs will come in. And so
Eat those aphids.
Yeah, man. Eat those aphids. And it's like, I don't know. I think of like a scary movie, because this is what it's about to happen, is if you have the patience, you could really watch the beauty of how this, it just all works together, right? So you have a host for a beautiful butterfly, its whole life cycle. And then you see, I don't know. And then you see ants and it just all works together.
Okay. So we don't have to worry about those aphids.
No, okay. No, okay. Sorry.
Good news, Andy. Good news. Well, Luis, I know the Civic Garden Center has a plant sale coming up on September 6th. Tell us about that.
Oh my gosh. That is something that I'm really excited about, out of many things that come out of the Civic Garden Center. Our team has been working tirelessly to make sure we propagate and provide the best native plants we can from our hoop house. We have, well, actually, just on the light of optimism, that is where the most recent place I saw a couple monarchs in.
Oh, so nice.
Yeah, it was a really fun moment where I had one of my team members called on our office phone, and I was at the front desk, and the call was, "Hey, Luis, like, I think I saw like a monarch butterflies like near the children's garden," and then it went away. And I ran out there, and turns out there were two monarch butterflies. Like, one was holding the other, like hanging on or something. And they went into the hoop house where we have our native plants that we've been working really, really hard to keep up. And so for this plant cell, we have native plants that we've been growing in-house, but we also have a collaborative effort to get a lot of local nurseries to come out and sell their native plants. So it is on September 6th. We are so excited to be able to provide that for our community. This will be the third time that this sale has been occurring. So I believe after 3 years, that's tradition.
That's right. It's a trend. Makes a trend. Three makes a trend in journalism.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So please come out. We'll have music. There's going to be food. You can find me with the bug net at the children's circle activities. We'll have, I'll give you a teaser trailer. We're all going to be, actually, I'll give myself a drum roll here. Oh, awesome. We have, you're going to get to be a bee, a butterfly, and a beetle in the children's circle. So if you have your kiddos, bring them out. We'll have fun. And there are going to be a lot of native plants to collect.
Sounds great. Well, I've been talking with Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, Ohio State University Extension Educator Carrie Brown, and Civic Garden Center Environmental Education Specialist Luis Aguilar-Dreyer. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Good to be here.
This was awesome.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.